one of the questions I had was about the flavors of the trains you're seeing in the galaxy. So what do you know about that, or what?
Right. So I can answer that at the start here. So the events that you saw in the presentation yesterday, those are the cascade events, and so those are essentially the electron or tau neutrinos, but also the neutral current interactions that are occurring. So you have neutrinos of all flavor there as well. I don't believe that we've yet completed the a direct flavor ratio test of the events in particular, and so that's something that's going to come, I think, in a future analysis. Yeah.
So that'll be within your reach at some point. Not now. It's 30 days.
Yeah, absolutely. So we do these. You'll see it. I'm pretty sure I've got it in one of the slides. We do a direct measure of the flavor ratio when we look at multiple data sets in IceCube, and so this will be a data set that gets added to that. And so usually there's not enough information in the single data set to really put hard constraints, and what you see is that the ratios that we see are generally 1-1-1 in terms of the flavors. So you get nearly perfect mixing, which is what the standard model predicts, right? So we haven't seen deviations from that. Go ahead, yeah.
For a lot of businesses, but that's kind of what was interesting, is that it sounds like you'd be able to give a flavor ratio story for nearby and then compare it to the flavor ratio story for a long ways away, which normally would be maximal mix.
I mean, at these energies, for even within the galaxy, I'd have to look, but I think I don't know that that you would predict a ratio that deviates significantly from the standard model.
Okay.
Yeah.
Unless you're seeing a model that would do that.
Yes. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Right. Okay.
Okay. So go ahead and take it away.
Thanks, Cliff. Thanks everyone who's there. Apologies, I can't be there. Fell quite ill, unfortunately. And my voice has returned over the last day, which is great. It's not 100%. My greatest appreciation to Ken, who's online, who jumped in at basically zero notice. He's my hero. This is incredibly hard to do. Even when you're fully prepared, and so you know, heroic efforts there. So greatest appreciation. What I'm going to present today is the last lecture, and this is going to focus on high energy neutrinos, which is close to my heart. The materials that have been presented, as you'll see, they all connect together. Materials are, of course, drawn from a wealth of sources online in the particle astro community. As I mentioned it before, it's a very vibrant community, and so today's lectures are pulling materials primarily from Professors Halsen and Rasconi, with some of my own materials mixed in. We've started with this image pretty much through the entire time that we've been looking at the particle astrophysics lectures. And you know, what you see is, of course, the cosmic ray spectrum here normalized to an E square flux as a function of energy. And the energy scale is going up to 10 to the 20 electron volts on the log scales, log. And so you see this wonderful spectrum that's been measured for over 100 years. As you get out to these extreme reaches here at the highest energies, what you're looking at there are events that are occurring on the Earth. We're measuring those at about a rate of 1 per square kilometer per year. And so you need enormous detectors in order to try and measure the flux that's out here. And what you've seen over the last few lectures is that you lose the ability to look at information in the electromagnetic spectrum, in particular in terms of photons and gamma rays. These get absorbed either on the cosmic microwave background or in the extragalactic background light as they propagate across the universe. And once you're above about a few tens of TeV, that absorption starts to take over. And so at the highest energies, although gamma rays are a wonderful probe of extreme objects in the local neighborhood, you lose that information as you try and look at the highest energies for the sources that are out in the extragalactic regions. Protons, of course, are reaching us. We're measuring these events up at 10 to the 19, 10 to the 20 electron volts. And this works extremely well when you want to measure the energy flux of the events. The challenge there, of course, is that these are charged particles. You have relatively high magnetic fields that are in the space between galaxies and within galaxies themselves. And so you lose the directionality. And so the question is, how do you probe out here in order to determine what the actual sources are where these events are originating and ultimately being accelerated? And it turns out that neutrinos are potentially the ideal messenger for this. They, of course, have the ability to largely escape from the regions where they're produced unimpeded, and they can carry that information directly from their point of origin to where you can ultimately detect them. So this is the region that we consider when we think about where neutrinos may be able to really provide some insight into what's happening in the galactic and extragalactic scales for the cosmic ray events. Now, if you look at the primary processes that are occurring, you take your favorite astrophysical accelerator. In this case, this is an artist's rendition of a blazar event. And so what you have is a supermassive black hole at the center. You have a large accretion disk that's around that. And as that matter is falling into the supermassive black hole, that gravitational energy is providing energy for the acceleration mechanism. You get tied up in shocks here. There's a plasma shockwave front that emerges, and you get this enormous beam or jet of energy that's emitted. Now, they're called blazars. Active galactic nuclei are called blazars when these emitted jets are oriented roughly in the direction of the Earth. So you're basically seeing that beam on pointing towards you when you see that event emerge in the sky. And so what you have are hadronic and leptonic processes that Ken has covered over the last couple of lectures. And you can see the primary interactions that are occurring there. The leptonic processes have been studied over the last lecture in some detail. The synchrotron and inverse Compton are the dominant modes that you see here, and those are producing the high energy gamma ray events that are emerging from these sources. You can also have the protons escape directly, and those are going to be the cosmic rays that make it to the Earth that are measured directly in the air shower experiments. And then you can have pion production, photopion production of the charged pions, which ultimately will decay into neutrinos that you can see in the processes here. And so these are the neutrinos that ultimately that we look for in the interactions on Earth and be able to point with those back in the sky to look for the events. Now, as Ken mentioned in the previous lecture, if you look at the proton event, the energy of the protons relative to the energy of the gamma rays, what you found is that there's a shift. So a proton that is at a TeV, the gamma rays that are produced in the interactions that you saw on the last page, it's basically a decrease of about a factor of 10. And you can see that here. So on these plots, you have the anticipated flux versus the ratio of the energy of your particle relative to the proton energy. And so if you have a proton accelerator that's operating at about 0.1 TeV or 100 GeV, so one is here, that's your proton energy, and then you can see the model for what you expect for the flux, for the gamma rays, and those peak at about a factor of 10 lower in terms of the expected flux spectrum. The neutrinos, those are coming off here, and they're peaking at about a factor of 2 lower than that, so a factor of 20 below the proton energy. And you see that basically holds if you go up a factor of 10,000, if you look at a PeV event. This is the same modeling for a proton that has energy of 1 PeV. And you can see that here, you expect the same relationship. And so this is kind of what you can expect going forward. Now the point is, of course, if I were to see neutrinos at the PeV level and above, what it means is that I have, is that I'm viewing proton accelerators that are operating at tens of PeV to hundreds of PeV and beyond, okay? So that's the takeaway message here, and that's how you can sort of correlate what I'll show you in the later slides with, you know, how this maps back to the cosmic ray spectrum that you saw on the earlier slide. Now, as I mentioned, the events at these energy scales are very, very rare, right? So you need enormous detectors in order to get a reasonable exposure that ultimately allows you to make measurements of events at these energies. And so I love this photo. This is Markov and Pontecorvo, two greats in the field of neutrinos. And it was Markov in 1960 who proposed for the first time that you could install detectors deep in a lake or a seabed in order to determine the direction of charged particles with the help of Cherenkov radiation. And this is going to become the fundamental principle for everything that you see in this talk from this point onward. What you have is, if you create, for instance, a lattice of light-sensitive detectors, what you're looking for is your neutrino entering, it interacts with a nucleus in the medium. Your medium needs to be transparent, but the charged particles that are produced in that neutrino interaction will move off at greater than the speed of light in the medium, and you'll produce Cherenkov radiation, which basically emits along a well-defined cone aligned with the direction that the particles are traveling. Now that light's emitted in the blue to UV wavelengths. It actually peaks in the UV. And so what you want to use are detectors that are sensitive to the blue and the UV light that ultimately allows you to determine the interactions that occurred here and then map that back not only to the primary particle, but then use that information to determine that primary particle's origin and the features of the astrophysical body from which it originated. Now, the beautiful thing here is that at the energies that we're talking about, muons, for instance, can travel enormous distances in water or ice. And in some cases, that can exceed, you know, 50 kilometers at that speed. And so you can obtain enormous amounts of information if you can build a large enough detector in order to make this measurement. Now, if you look at the largest detector that we've created, this is an artificially controlled detector. It was called the Super Kamiokande detector. This is an absolutely wonderful photo. This is 50 kilotons of water, ultra pure water. What you see are 20 inch photomultiplier tubes that are lining the walls of this huge cylinder. These are two people in a boat that are testing those photomultiplier tubes as the water level is increasing in this enormous chamber. And this is the detector that made the first discovery of neutrino oscillations in measurements of atmospheric neutrinos. And so these energies for the atmospheric neutrinos were at the GeV scale, okay? This detector, looking at GeV neutrinos, is about 10,000 times too small if you want to be looking at neutrinos at the high energies, TeV and PeV scales and above, in order to ultimately conduct neutrino astronomy. And so what we do is we take the guidance from Markov, and we look at where you can possibly build these types of detectors using natural media. And so the key here is you find yourself optically clear, shielded, transparent, ultimately optically transparent medium, which where you can reduce the cosmic rays. So what you'll see in a few slides is that the cosmic rays absolutely dominate as a background. And so it's always a bit amusing that one person's signal is another person's background. But for the rare events that you're looking for in neutrinos, it's essentially a needle in a haystack search, and you'll see why. Once you have selected your location, you have to map its optical properties. And this is slightly different than most of the detectors that people think about, because in most cases, for instance, with Super K, you control your medium to great precision. You can purify the water, you can measure the optical properties and basically have uniform optical properties in that region. When you're dealing with a natural source, like an ice sheet or an active large body of water, you have no control over what your ultimate medium is. Okay. The key to building these detectors is just fill them with optical sensors so that you can capture as much of the Cherenkov radiation as you can in order to make that the measurement of the event interactions. And then you offboard the data from your photomultiplier tubes into your computing systems so that you can ultimately conduct your data analyses. Okay. So the largest detector to date is located here at the South Pole, which is really quite a remarkable place to think about when you do this. On this line that you see here, this is the skiway at South Pole Station, Antarctica. The little barbershop pole is over here behind the main station that you see here. This was when the station was still under construction, the newest Amundsen Scott South Pole Station. That skiway is where Hercules C-130 aircraft land on skis, bringing people and cargo. And then over here, what you see is the ice cube drill camp while the detector was under construction between 2004 and 2010. And what we're doing here is basically leveraging the properties of a 3 kilometer deep ice sheet that's located at the South Pole. So if you go quite deep into we end up going 2.5 kilometers into that glacial ice sheet to escape the cosmic ray radiation interactions that are occurring in our atmosphere, providing background. There's exquisite transparency of the ice once you're below about a kilometer and a half. And because of that, you have absolutely enormous absorption lengths in the ice, meaning that the probability that a photon, a Cherenkov photon, can travel in excess of 100 to 200 meters before it sees a single scattering point, or sorry, before it has a probability of absorption, is the primary criteria. So you can build an enormous detector, and you can be and because you understand those properties, you can be confident that the light that's produced within that region is going to ultimately have a high probability of making it to your detector sensors. So a few years ago, a little over a decade ago, this is what you would have seen as on that glacial sheet. If you're looking back here, just on the horizon, about a kilometer away, you can see the that is the station where people live. And this was the ice cube drill camp. And what you see are these red cargo trailers. And they're basically burning jet fuel to generate hot water. It's a hot water drill system where you have on the order of 4 to 5 megawatts of thermal power being generated to produce hot water heaters. And that hot water is focused through this hose reel. You can see there's a person right there for size. There's a person here for size and a person here. That water goes into the hose reel. It's going to go up into this tower, and then we're going to focus all of that hot water energy into a 1/4-inch nozzle. We're going to point that into the glacier. And that's going to melt its way into the glacier 2.5 kilometers down. And what we're able to do is melt a hole that's about a half a meter across, 2.5 kilometers long. We melt it in something on the order of about 18 hours, okay, which is just an enormous feat in itself. That hole is going to remain liquid for about a 24-hour period of time. And so while it's liquid, oh, here, and so I'll show you the animation here. And so the top layer is what we call the fern. It's a bit fluffy. It's the compacting snow. And so we melt that with a hot water coil, which you saw there. And then this is the hot water drill, which is taking the full power of that drill system. And it just melts its way into the glacier, leaving you with a liquid hole. Now that hole remains open. It remains liquid for about 24 hours, give or take. And while it's liquid, what you do is you take an ice cube sensor, one that you see here, you attach it to your power and communication line, and then you lower it into the hole. And you repeat that 60 times for every hole until you create what we call a string of optical sensors in the that ultimately makes up your detector. When you have it all completed, what you end up with is the world's largest neutrino detector. And this is just a sec. This is 86 strings of these digital optical modules, a diagram, an image that you see here, and we'll talk about that in the next slide. But you have a hybrid observatory where you have a full-scale optical array, which is in the very deep ice, which is looking for the astrophysical events. There's a surface array of detectors which are looking for cosmic ray events from above. And then there is a very dense concentration of instrumentation at the center, which is looking at lower energy events. And these are studying neutrino properties from, for instance, atmospheric neutrino interactions. And just to give you a sense of scale, what you see here is the Eiffel Tower, okay? So this fills more than a cubic kilometer of instrumented volume in order to look for the highest energy neutrinos that we've ever detected. The way that we detect them is shown here, and it's really quite beautiful in its simplicity. This is just a 10-inch photomultiplier tube, and what we do is we encapsulate it in a glass pressure housing to protect it from the glacier refreezing. And then we have a auto, and then it's fully autonomous on board, excuse me, data acquisition and power and communications. And so each of these operate as an individual detector. You have 60 of them on every one of your strings. And each of them is looking out for the Cherenkov radiation for the events that occur. This is an example of what you see. So there's more than 5,000 of these digital optical modules currently operating in the ice. And you can see how this instrument works in unison. For instance, for a high energy muon that was produced in a cosmic ray event and then penetrated through the ice top. So this is an air shower from above. You have a muon of very high energy, which was able to penetrate. The 2.5 kilometers into the ice, and you can see red light is early, blue-green light is late, and this is a downward going event in the detector. Just a second. Okay.
While you're paused there, Eric.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Is the when in that color timing the color means timing is the same is the timing is the same scale for the ice top as it is for the ray, the deep core, and the rest of it? So
Yes,
does red.
now same color scale. So what you're seeing there is this shower, which produced the muon, which went into the deep ice, sorry, was angled. It's basically coming in here. You can see early light hit those that array of detectors in this corner, and then ultimately the shower evolved out over into the edges here. And so this is an event which came in at an angle. It produced that high energy muon, and that high energy muon is what ultimately penetrates here. Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay. So you have sensitivity. Sorry, if you look at the if you look at the topology or morphology of your events, you can tell what type of event they are. So for muons, muons of course are depositing their energy as they propagate through the detector at a steady rate. And so you get this beautiful track that appears, okay? For cascade events, electrons, tau neutrinos, low energy tau neutrinos, and the neutral current interactions of all flavors, you basically get an electromagnetic shower in the local region of the detector, and it looks like a big fuzzy sphere that emerges from the center point and then expands outwards. And then you have sensitivity to specifically to tau type neutrinos, where you have the tau neutrino that enters. Our neutrino interacts and you get your initial shower, which then produces the tau lepton. That tau lepton, depending on its energy, will travel some distance in the detector, at which point it'll decay. And that produces a second shower of events within the same event time window. And so you ultimately get what we call a double bang event. And we'll go through each of these in turn through the next part of the talk. Now, the backgrounds, of course, are absolutely key. If you look at the Earth, this is the ice cube detector, of course, not to scale, but this is the detector's horizon, which becomes quite important in terms of looking for the specific neutrino events. And so what you find is that oops. What you find is that things that are coming down on the detector, these are primarily going to be dominated by backgrounds from the cosmic ray air showers. And so you're going to see a lot of muons entering the detector from those interactions. There are neutrinos, of course, in this direction. It's just harder to find them. And the collaboration has gone through extensive efforts to be able to look up into that region of the sky. But as we discussed last week, the efficiency for that is not the same as if you're looking for things that are coming up. Things that are coming up from this part of the horizon, sorry, up towards the horizon of the detector. Those have to be neutrinos. We don't know of any other particles that can traverse that much material without being absorbed. And so we know that those are neutrino events. And then at the horizon itself, you're subject to this is sort of the breaking point where you can look for your golden events of neutrinos versus the dominant backgrounds from air shower events. Now, just to give you a feeling, this is just a few seconds of what we see in the detector. And what you just saw there was a high energy muon that entered the detector, and you see a number of these. And so this is ultimately the data sampling over a few seconds of the detector's operation. And what you're ultimately looking for are the neutrino events, which are a few a month at the energies that we're looking at in a detector our size. And so this is the process that you ultimately have to extract from the data. Okay, so if you look at how you do this, this is the number of events. This is 10 to the 9 down to a single event rate. And then this is cosine of the zenith angle. So this is looking up from the detector. This is looking down, so from above. And zero is at the horizon. And what you see is that you're completely dominated, of course, by downgoing muons from your air showers. And so you have to make your techniques in order to cut these away in order to reach the first level of neutrinos, and those are going to be the atmospheric neutrinos that are produced in those air shower events from the cosmic rays. And then ultimately, what you want to do is go down another factor of 1,000 from there to look for the astrophysical neutrino events that were expected to be observable from the galactic and extragalactic sources. And so one approach, of course, is that you can simply cut away at the horizon, and that gets you a long way, as it allows you to separate yourself away from that dominant muon background. As you see here, it falls off very quickly near the horizon. And just look for the upgoing events. And that approach works, but it provides you with a limited ability to utilize the full capacity of your detector. So one of the mechanisms, one of the techniques that was developed is what we call starting event searches. And here, what we did is we utilize some of the actual detector as a veto around the detector itself. So we define a region around the detector where the instrumentation there is used to identify light from muon events that would be entering the detector from outside. And so a muon, as it enters, it's going to leave its energy through this track that we saw before. And so it'll deposit charge here, which is detectable. And we can ultimately identify that trigger on it and say, okay, this was a muon event because we know that it came from outside. And so we can remove that from our data set. And ultimately, we look for the events that are starting in what we call the active regions that you see here and here in the rectangular boxes. Now, the first type of event, which really has an advantage for this type of search, is going to be the electron showers or the cascade events that we saw earlier. And the reason for that is because when they start in the detector as a neutrino interaction, they're going to basically deposit all of their energy in that local region through a showering process, and then make it possible to detect that light in that local region, and you know exactly where it started. So if you're in that active region that I showed you before, you basically have a golden signature for a neutrino event, right? And so you can see the light propagation in a simulation for one of these really high energy, this is PEV cascade event. And it's just this beautiful shower. These are the photons that are moving out from the interaction point and the particle interaction points that are producing the photons in the detector. And then you can see these are your detector strings that you see around the event itself. And again, the light here is the color of the light is the timing, and the size of each of the lines of these photons. That's equivalent to the energy that's being deposited in that event. Now, when you take that information, that light goes outwards and it reaches your photomultiplier tubes. And so you see that here. And so this is a high energy cascade event that was observed in IceCube. And again, the color scale here is timing, and the size of the spheres are related to the charge that was observed in that local region, okay? And you can see you have the highest charge in the center here, and then the charge falls off as you go out, as your event basically expands outwards from the interaction point, which is exactly what you would expect. And what you see are the waveforms from each of the photomultiplier tubes. These are the highest energy photomultiplier tubes that were extracted in this event. And you can see those waveforms. And so this is charge versus timing for each of those 10-inch photomultiplier tubes in the event that it observes. Okay. So this technique works, and it allowed us to discover the first two astrophysical neutrino events ever observed. And so you see them here, which you have are two events that exceed a PEV in energy. There are these beautiful cascade events. You can see the interaction points here at the center at very early timing, and then the light and the charge as it reaches out from that central interaction point. And of course, we gave them appropriate names. We called them Bert and Ernie. And then we enhanced the data set on which this technique was performed. And what we saw was another 26 events emerged. And we kept naming them after Muppets. We lost energy doing that for a while. After a while, it's not that you run out of Muppets necessarily, it just gets, you know, more confusing. But in the second data set, Big Bird arrived, 2 PeV in energy, the highest energy neutrino that was observed up until that point in time. And ultimately, what you saw in that search after 2,000 days of data was this: using that specific technique, what you ultimately find, just a second. What you ultimately find is this bump that emerges in your data, okay? Out at these very high energies, well above the background expectations that you expect. And that's exactly what you hope to see. And so this was at 6 sigma, and it's now crossing 10 sigma in terms of the overall sensitivity. Okay. Now, this is the resolution that you can expect in those events. And so you're looking at events that are big fuzzy balls in the detector, fuzzy spheres. And so it's hard to use that as pointing. You get some leverage in terms of pointing if you look at the timing that as the shower evolves, the shower is, the showered particles are aligned with the direction of the original neutrino, but you have to try and extract that fully. And so, excuse me, you can do that at sort of a few degrees once you get out to the very high energies. And once you're if at lower energies, it's somewhere between 5 and 10 degrees overall. So if you try and look at where these events were coming from in the sky, this is what you would ultimately see. You don't get great resolution. This is with just 2 years of data at the time. And so you don't have great resolution in terms of what's happening out there in the sky. The ones that are quite a bit smaller in scale, these are muon type events that were in the detector. You can see you get much better pointing with those. If you have more than a kilometer long track, and you just do a linear fit to that, you can get exquisite pointing from that type of reconstruction. I'm going to pause there just for a second. Okay. And so this is the muon type event that you see. This is a simulation of what you expect from a muon. And what you have is the muon producing energy as it traverses. But you also have enormous amounts of energy deposited along that track. And so those are three stochastic processes that are occurring. And so you're looking for collecting the energy as your particle traverses your detector. And these are the processes that can be occurring in that muon path. And so if you look at the actual energy as it's deposited as a function of time along that track, you can see that it's quite clumpy in nature, and these are due to the hard bruns that are occurring where you get enormous amounts of energy deposited in local regions, but also essentially a steady state of energy that's being deposited over time as a minimum ionizing particle. If you look at the muon events in the detector over a multi-year data set, this is exactly what you see. You can see those muon events as they fall down here. And what you find is that the conventional atmospheric expectation for muons follows this line. And you see this wonderful bump emerge in your data, which agrees perfectly with what you expect for your astrophysical flux In this case, I believe that flux model was an E square e to the minus 2 spectrum. And you see just wonderful data Monte Carlo agreement as you go out to these highest energies for the muon events that have been observed. Now, when you put that together with what we had for the cascade events, cascade type events that you saw earlier, what you find is really quite wonderful. These things basically fall within the same plane in terms of the flux versus the neutrino energy. So what you can conclude from this is that, well, one of the things that you can conclude from this is that ultimately they appear to be coming from a similar sampling of sources, right? The flux basically falls together in this high energy regime that you see here. Okay. Now for the tau events, these are still something that are emerging for us. They're harder to find in the detector. And as we described, ultimately what you're looking for is this double bang process occurring in your detector. And keep in mind, the tau, if you have a tau that's being produced at PeV energy, it's going to travel about 50 meters in your detector. So this separation distance here is on the order of tens of meters that you're looking for between your two events. And so if you look at the waveform for the events that survive the quality selection, what you see is here. And you can see this double bang structure occur in the waveform of the photomultiplier tubes between the initial interaction and then what is ultimately the tau decaying in the event. And in this particular event, we were able to do a separation, which at a best fit, that length was about 17 meters overall. And you can see one of the you can see that event here. So this is the event view. This is the interaction that occurs, and then it's evolving and moving off in this direction. And here are the photomultiplier tube waveforms, and you can see this double peak structure emerges in those waveforms. And so this is a classic signature of what you would expect to see in a neutrino, a tau neutrino interaction, and then ultimately the tau decaying in that event window. Okay. Now, when you put it all together, this comes back to what Cliff was asking about at the start. You can map overall the fraction of events that are tau-like, muon-like, and electron-like in your detector. And we call this a flavor triangle. And you can perform an overall fit where you have an expectation, for instance, that your fraction of the muon, sorry, the fraction of the neutrinos that are muon-like are between 0 and 1, and similarly for the electron and the tau flavors. And what you find is this wonderful fit that occurs where the probability, sorry, the best fit is landing right about here. Based on different and then different models, but you are landing in a regime where the overall neutrinos that we're seeing to date, and this was using 7.5 years of the starting event search data set, landing in the middle here is basically the expectation of the standard model where you just have perfect mixing to 1 to 1 to 1 over the cosmic distances that these events are traversing. Okay. What was really quite nice to see is that in the best fit of the data, the contour has now closed, and that's coming out in a new result in the future where the tau neutrinos are showing their presence. Okay. Next, what I want to talk about is one of the highest energy events that we've measured to date. This one falls in an absolute sweet spot in terms of the particle physics community. Glasschow predicted that the interaction of the neutrino on the CMB should create a resonance, a W resonance, which amplifies the expectation for that signal at about 6.3 PeV. And that was a standard model prediction at the time. I believe it was from the 1960s. And this is the first observation of such an event where we had the event here. It basically started at the edge of our detector and moved inwards. And you can see this wonderful cascade event here in this orientation of the event view, extremely high energy. You can tell that by the amount of charge which was deposited in the photomultiplier tubes. And it fit to an energy that was exactly at the Glasschow resonance, the predicted Glasschow resonance of 6.3 PeV. And so this has now been published, and it was the first observation of this process. I'm going to skip past that one. Now, if you take some of our most recent data, you can see the starting event search, the upward going muons plotted in this band in the Glasschow event, and you see this lovely spectrum. That where everything is basically fitting very nicely together in terms of this over this energy range up into the PeV scale now. This is 10 PeV. There are one or two events that are estimated to be out here in the tens of PeV at this point, not yet added to this plot. You can start to do astronomy with this information. In particular, if you take these various data sets, you can fit what we call the spectral index for each. And what you see is that for the best fit, you can think of this as a Venn diagram, where the best fit is shown here in the star, and things are nominally in good agreement with each other using the different types of data sets in how we slice our information for the various techniques that are used to identify the neutrino candidates. Okay, so let's do a little bit of astronomy. This is the event that really, when we look back, is the one that launched neutrino astronomy in a big way. what you have is this absolutely beautiful muon. It's coming upward in the detector, so you know that is a golden neutrino event. You can see it entering from the right, exiting on the left. This is about 300 TeV in energy when you do your energy reconstruction. When you have events like this, what you do is we have a system which alerts the astronomical community. It gives them a pointing for where we think it came from and a probability that it's an astrophysical neutrino event. And we send that out. We call that a circular. We send that out to the astronomical community. And they follow this up to look and see if there's something interesting happening in the sky. In this particular case, in 2017, it ended up being followed up by a huge number of observatories in space and on the ground around the globe. And the reason for that is that the Fermi telescope detected that there is a blazar, so a supermassive black hole, with its jet basically aligned towards the Earth, and it was in a state of heightened activity. It was flaring, in coincident with the time, shortly after the time when this neutrino arrived from exactly that direction. So this is the contour that Ice Cube sent out and said, please look here. And Fermi looked there, and right at the center of that contour was this blazar that had emerged into this flaring state. And then the high energy gamma ray community pointed their instruments at the object. And MAGIC, one of the Eyre-Sharonkov telescopes that Ken discussed previously, it saw this peak in the gamma ray TeV, high GeV and TeV gamma ray spectrum at more than 7 sigma. And again, this is confirming that blazar was in a flaring state. Now, if you look at how this all proceeds, Ice Cube sends out an alert, and then there's a robotic telescope system which followed up in just a minute after that alert, and then the information from the broad community started to come in as well as instruments focused on this particular event in that region of the sky. And so what we found is really quite remarkable. This event, this object had been known as as an active blazar since the 1950s, but it looked relatively dim, and there wasn't a lot of study that had occurred. It turns out that the measurements that were performed as a follow-up on the Ice Cube neutrino alert finds that blazar is basically at the opposite side of the universe. It's 4 billion years away from us. And when you extrapolate the intensity of that source of what you're seeing, the luminosity that it's producing, as a function of that distance, it's actually one of the brightest objects in our sky. Okay, and we didn't actually realize this until these studies were performed. Now, if you take the standard plot that you've been looking at for a couple of days now, what you find is the spectral energy distribution across, and you can just see this huge amount of information from all of these instruments that were studying the sky at that point in time, following up this neutrino alert. And you can see it just fill in the synchrotron peak, the inverse Compton peak that you have from the high energy gamma range, and then now the new information that comes in from adding in the neutrino information. Now, as we said, there was an automated telescope system which followed up after a minute. It basically, the alert came, it pointed the telescopes that were visible in that region, and it looked at that blazar. And what they found was really quite remarkable. The blazar was not in its flaring state at that point in time, but it essentially switched on about 2 hours after, in the optical range, after the Ice Cube event alerted it. Okay, and it's really quite remarkable that that off to on switch was observed at 50 sigma significance. And you see the same thing in the high energy gamma rays. So if you look at Fermi, and if you look at the Fermi data, keep in mind Fermilat is this satellite, and it's basically sweeping out the sky multiple times a day. And you can see that data here. It basically moves from an off state at the point of the neutrino alert to this on state where the flare emerges. And similarly, you can see the same thing in terms of MAGIC. But the higher energy TeV flux appears at about 5 days. It starts to turn on after about 5 days that you see here. Okay, so there's an evolution of the source being witnessed, of this type of source being witnessed really for the first time, based on this alert. And this goes to the heart of what you have in terms of what the multi-messenger technique can be as a really powerful tool for really diving into new phenomena in the universe. Now, what Ice Cube did is we looked back in our data set and we said, this is an interesting object. If we look at what was happening with this object over the lifetime of the Ice Cube detector operating, do we see anything interesting? And the answer is yes. If you look back in that data set, in late 2014, early 2015, what we see, and at the crosshairs here, that is that blazar, TXS-0506-056. You see this flare of neutrinos, and I'll display it again, that basically comes and then it goes away over a multi-month period of time. And which you if you look at the, now there wasn't an alert at that time, but like I said, detectors like the Fermi telescope are looking at that part of the sky. It's sweeping out that part of the sky all the time. And so you can look at what was seen in the gamma ray spectrum, for instance, and it's absolutely silent. There's no indication of activity, of enhanced activity from that blazar during that 2014-15 period when we saw a high number of neutrinos come from that object, okay? And similarly, in the optical range, you see something similar. You really see that it's an acquiescent period at the time when that neutrino flare occurs, okay? And ultimately, what's remarkable is that this source has been quiet. If you look 10 years before and now 3 years after the Ice Cube event occurred, this is, you know, you see that that source went into a flaring state in 2017 in terms of the gamma rays and the optical EM, in the EM electromagnetic, but not in terms of, not necessarily correlated with when the neutrinos are actually being produced in that region. Now, those types of puzzles are absolutely wonderful things. And they generate huge numbers of papers as people try and sort through what exactly is going on with this object, right? And there's some ideas, for instance, that this blazar, that there may be a supermassive star which is orbiting the blazar, and that is causing the jet to move between regions where the jet is perhaps obscured in a local dust region, interstellar region. Just a second. Okay. Sorry. There's models where it's the possibility that what we're seeing is a merging galaxy, where you have two supermassive black holes that are coming together, and you have sorry, more than one jet in the region that you're actually seeing the acceleration properties from. Some wonderful models about whether the jet is actually being warped instead of just a straight emission, that it actually is being bent due to local features. And the thing is that we still don't know, but it is absolutely become a fantastic area of the sky that people are studying. I'm going to pause and see if people have any questions before I go.
Is there any way to distinguish those models?
I think that time will tell as we add more data and we have, you know, and we're able to study this object. It would be fantastic if it were to, evolve, right? As I said, it's gone into a quiet state, right? And so I think what will end up happening is if it emerges from that state, it'll give us some handle on how to separate between these types of models. But today, the data, the information isn't there. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay. So if you look back at the sky, this is the 6-year data set of cascade type events and where we think that they were coming from. And if you look at the current state of the art, and you've seen this is the 10-year ice cube map. And what we see is the emergence of what we'll call steady state sources. So the blazar that we discussed previously, that really is a transient event. Something caused that blazar to flare, and so we had this high energy neutrino that suddenly arrived from it in coincidence with that flaring. And so that's a transient event. But if you just look at the exposure of the sky over a long period of time as you collect your statistics, steady state sources that are continuously emitting neutrinos should pop out at you. This is the brightest in our catalog to date. There's a handful that are now above 3 sigma. NGC 1068 or M77, a Messier object that's been observed optically for hundreds of years. This is the hottest source. It now exceeds 4.5 sigma, approaching 5 sigma threshold in terms of neutrinos emitting from that particular region. And this is a wonderful object. It's nearby. It's something that has been studied in great detail for years because it's one of the first bright objects that was observed, by astronomers in the 1700s. And so what we know is that it appears to be a non-jetted active galactic nuclei, meaning that there doesn't appear to be a specific intense jet emerging from the supermassive black hole of this spiral galaxy. It's also a very high active region in terms of star formation activity. And so there's a lot going on here. But the central picture is the following, where you have a supermassive black hole surrounded by your accretion disk, where you have your infalling matter into that supermassive black hole. And what you ultimately end up with is energy being released in a hot corona, which surrounds this region here. And that's a ultra hot gas, which allows you to accelerate to the TeV, high TeV range in terms of energy. And so if you look at the modeling for something like this, this is the cartoon for that, where you have radiatively inefficient accretion outflow, but you can accelerate your electrons and protons in the high fields in these regions here. And so you'll have emission. The expectation is that you'll have emission of your neutrinos in these hot gas regions that you have here. And then you'll have optical and UV in this range, and then X-ray emission where you see the ultra hot corona being formed through the synchrotron process. Okay. All right. So what's coming next in the last few minutes? We have neutrinos observed in coincidence with gamma rays, and we've had gravitational waves observed in coincidence with the electromagnetic spectrum. But we haven't yet put all of these three things together. And I think that's where we're ultimately heading towards, will be the first measurement where you have an object which produces the information and is ultimately observed in the three primary messengers, electromagnetic, gravitational, and neutrinos. And timing is wonderful for this. The LIGO experiment, LIGO Virgo Chagra, have just entered. They've just commenced run four. And so that is now underway over the next year and a half, approximately. And so this is after the full upgrade of the LIGO instrument to enhance its sensitivity. So this is a fantastic era for looking for these types of events. In 2017, there was this absolutely wonderful neutron star merger, which occurs, which produced a kilonova. This was huge for the astronomical community. The electromagnetic follow-up of this was amazing. It was the first time that that basically astronomers were able to see the onset of a kilonova event from that neutron star merger, and that was due to the fact that the gravitational waves gave that signal to point there. Unfortunately, in this particular case, the event occurred off axis. So the gamma ray burst, there was a short gamma ray burst that occurred, but it was not aligned with the Earth. And we would have expected the neutrinos, if you look at the model for one of the popular models for how this process is expected to occur, the neutrinos are expected to be in the jet of that gamma ray burst. And so because it wasn't aligned, we didn't see neutrinos in Ice Cube, for instance, in correlation with this particular event. That's thought, you know, it's hoped that that's just bad luck, and that when the next one of these is observed, we'll actually have a three coincident event. Now, if you look at where we are today, you've seen some of these plots before. There's in terms of the electromagnetic spectrum, this is the neutrino spectrum. If you look at neutrino flux as a function of energy and all of the sources, and what's really wonderful now is that the Ice Cube data has started to fill in this region. Now, if you want to go beyond Ice Cube to the highest energies, You have to start to target new techniques, because doing this in the optical regime with Cherenkov radiation, it becomes really inefficient. It's just expensive in order to expand your detector to the scales that you would need in order to go up, you know, orders of magnitude and energy. One of the techniques that people are harnessing is called the Iskarian effect. And I'm going to flip through these quickly, but in principle, it's very simple. You have a shower which occurs, and there's charge separation that can occur in that showering effect, and that can just be due to the magnetic field of the Earth. It'll separate your charges of your particles, and that ultimately forms a current, and that current changes as a function of distance in the shower and time. And so a change in current, of course, gives you electromagnetic emission. And in this case, if you look in the radio frequencies, you can see this exactly. You basically get an enhancement in the radio where you get a forward emission, which builds on top of each other, and you get a much higher signal in that radio regime, in the radio radiation along from the shower, if that occurs. So if you have a neutrino that interacts in a dielectric medium and the shower is produced, then that in the Iskarian effect basically creates a focused radiation in the radio frequency that you can measure at some observatory that you've created up here near the surface. And so these are radio antennae in the deeper ice, 200 meters and near the surface. And you can look for the Siskarian radiation, which is produced in these really high energy neutrino interactions that are expected to occur. So the proof of principle has been under development for a number of years with some technologies that have occurred in Antarctica, but the cutting edge is now happening in Greenland at the ice sheet there called Summit Station, which is in the central region of the Greenland continent that you see here. And what people are building are these radio antenna stations deployed on tens of kilometer scale. The goal at the moment is to achieve a 37 station array that you can see here, very close to the Summit Station, and look for the first events that would be at the 100 PeV energy and above. Okay, I'm going to skip that one and go to this one. And you don't have to necessarily bury your detectors in the ice. You can use the ice as your exposure volume for this event, and you can put your antennas on large ballooning projects. And that's done here, for instance, with ANITA experiment, where you have these directional antennas in the radio frequency basically pointing downwards towards your ice sheet, looking for those signatures to emerge from the ice sheet in order to see the events. Okay. And this is taking, this was ANITA in its fourth iteration, ballooning around Antarctica in this case. I think it was for almost a month. And then the next generation of this is called PUEO, and it's currently under construction with its launch planned in a couple of years' time. Okay, last but not least, future outlook. IceCube is starting construction again. And in this case, what we're doing is we're building seven new strings of detectors, which are going to be deployed in the central region of the array. And the goal here is to really target how well we know the ice. The knowledge of the natural medium is one of the key systematic uncertainties in the detector. And so we have advanced detectors with onboard calibration systems and special calibration devices, which are going to allow us to significantly improve our knowledge of the overall behavior of the ice throughout the entire array. And that ultimately is going to allow us to go back and reanalyze more than 15 years of the data that we've collected. And the current projections is that we'll improve on that data set by at least a factor of two from where we are today. And so that's the first step in the process. If you look more globally, this field is exploding. IceCube and Antares were the first, AMANDA at the South Pole and Antares in the Mediterranean Sea were the first two detectors. IceCube is the largest and has been leading much of the discovery frontier over the last decade. But other detectors have been busily under construction. So you have KM3Net, which is planned to be slightly larger than IceCube in the deep Mediterranean Sea, off of the coast of both Italy, and another array off of the coast of France. You have GVD, which is in Lake Baikal in Russia that you see here. And then a new effort that's underway in the Pacific Ocean, just off the coast of the US and Canada, that's located here in the deep Pacific Ocean. This is KM3Net. It looks a lot like IceCube, except it's in water. You have next generation detectors where you have small photomultiplier tubes pointing in many directions, giving you beautiful photocathode coverage for your instrument. I love this image. This is how they deploy these strings. They have them nested into these spheres, and then they basically launch the sphere into the Mediterranean Sea. And as it falls, there's this wonderful video. I don't have it in the slides here, but as it falls to the Mediterranean bed, it unfurls, and you get your strings that then are held into place, and then the buoys that basically keep them as taut strings of detectors in your array. And it's under construction, but it's already seeing neutrino events. Red is early, blue is late, and so in this partially constructed detector, they're already seeing high energy neutrino events coming up into the detector region. Similarly, GVD, this is the one in Russia. This is large. I think this is a 10-inch photomultiplier tube, again in a pressure housing. In this case, it's a lot like ice fishing. When the lake is frozen for a long part of the year, they go out onto the ice, and they basically melt their way through that surface layer, and then deploy their strings of detectors into these clusters that you see here. And so same principle, strings of photomultiplier tube detectors in pressure housings that are in the lake body, in these clusters. And they're approaching a cubic kilometer scale at this point in time. So slightly smaller at the moment, I believe, than Ice Cube, but they're getting close. And these are some of the first high energy neutrino events that they're seeing in their detector clusters. And so that's running beautifully. And then P1, the Pacific Ocean Neutrino Detector. This is the Cascadia Basin, where there is power and communication infrastructure for deep ocean measurements. And the plan there, and it's already funding now for, I believe, 5 or 6 strings of detectors. The first ones to be deployed in that region, which will ultimately make a multi-cubic kilometer detector array. And then taking the step beyond, you can imagine scaling these things to 10 cubic kilometers and beyond. And so one of those is called Ice Cube Gen 2. Just a second, sorry. There we go. Where you can see this is Ice Cube upgrade, this is Ice Cube, this is the layout for a nearly 10 cubic kilometer detector array that surrounds Ice Cube, and then a full-scale radio array, excuse me, that would harness the Iskarian technique. And that scale there is 5 kilometers, so this is enormous. In order to reach things like what you could do here, where if you take the Texas flare that occurred and you look to get a 5 sigma sensitivity to a single flare of the same nature, you can see that with Gen 2, you immediately have access to seeing a full flare that would trigger, but then over time, more than orders of magnitude. More than an order of magnitude improvement. And when you put all of this together, this is the last slide, this is what you can imagine in the future as all of these instruments come online. They have sensitivity based on where they, so the highest sensitivity for the highest energy events are relatively close to the horizon. So when you're looking back in the sky, your sensitivity sweeps out different areas of the sky for each of the different detectors. And so when you put them all together, what you can imagine is a global neutrino network of detectors that are communicating together in order to give you nearly complete coverage of the sky at any point in time, right? And that's where your field ultimately moves from a discovery area to actually becoming a vibrant field that's performing particle astrophysics in a complete way. I'll pause there.
Thank you very much, Darren and Ken as well, for not just this lecture, but for the whole series. Other questions? If not, I had one. Why don't you have whales going through the snakes underwater?
You do. So I have to look and see. I mean, the truth is that in the water-based detectors, you do have biological activity that's occurring, right? And so that's something that you have to build for. We know, for instance, that bioluminescence is one of the primary noise signatures that occur in these detectors, right? And this was seen early on with one of the early detector arrays in the Mediterranean, where they actually measured the signature of bioluminescence. So this would be not whales, but small organisms that bioluminesce, and they would basically move with the current flow, and you could see that enter and leave your detector array over time, right? And so this is something that you have to build into your models, which is a little bit it's challenging, right? Because it's kind of a random element, but it's something that you can build into your models, and you can build into, for instance, your triggering system, so that you're not overwhelmed by that amount of light when it arrives. Yeah.
Amazing.
I have a question. For the blazar detection, is it possible to also observe neutrinos from like blazars or other types of AGN? Is it just because the blazars pointing directly at us that we're able to see them?
No, I think you're absolutely right. We should be able to see them from other types of AGN. And we see that, for instance, with NGC 1068. So that one is not jetting. And so there's no blazar occurring there, right? And so the mechanism for where the neutrinos are being produced in terms of the acceleration that's occurring in NGC 1068 is going to be different from what we saw for the Texas, the TXS 0506, right? And so we're seeing that yes, the different types of these sources are emerging as neutrino sources, and and then each one is sort of adding to the information on how those different types of sources are ultimately behaving, if that makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Are you at a place where, now that there's actually evidence that people know where cosmic rays are coming from, can you distinguish out there's the cannonball model and the shock front model? Can you distinguish which one is right, or is that not there yet?
I think we're not there yet. Yeah, so if I remember right, for instance, the cannonball model, if my memory, I'm digging back here, I think that's related to the gamma ray burst. It's a gamma ray burst model. Now we haven't seen neutrinos correlated with gamma ray bursts yet. We've looked, and that correlation hasn't emerged. And in fact, the models are moving, because of the limits that are being imposed based on those observations is what I remember seeing last. Yeah.
It's a good sign that the models are moving. It means you're hurting them.
it's the classic, yeah, it's the classic, you know, someone imposes limits, you know, and then which is a wonderful process, right? The observations you know, basically bring the new information, and then the models are you know, the models evolve. Yeah.
Well, unless there are any other questions, I think we're ready for lunch here. So thanks again, you two.